Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Jessica with Syosset Libraries Turn the Page podcast, and I have a really exciting guest today.
Yeah, hi, I'm Sarah Gailey, author of Magic for Liars and Upright Women Wanted,
which are both really, really awesome books. And you have a middle grade book as well. Not middle grade, man, it's like YA, right?
Yes, yeah. my young adult debut came out this year, When We Were Magic, from Simon Pulse.
So your books came on my radar. I was wandering New York Comic Con last October, which who knows when that's going to happen again.
Oh my goodness.
And I heard one of the people at the booth pitching Upright Women Wanted. And I heard librarians fighting against oppression in a Wild West setting, and I was like sold. And they're like, oh, did you know they also wrote this book, Magic for Liars? And I'm like, double sold. So that's how I came about reading both of your books back to back. Was Magic for Liars your debut?
Yes, Magic for Liars was my adult novel debut. Prior to that, I did have a couple of novellas come out from Tor.com. The American Hippo series is a pulp western series that takes place in an alternate history of America, in which we passed a bill that was an actual bill that almost got passed in the U.S. to import hippos to be raised for meat as livestock.
Wow. So when was that bill almost passed?
That was, oh gosh, let me not mix up my alternate history timeline with the real
actual
timeline.
Actual history timeline.
Yeah. That was in the early 1900s, in the early 20th century. Basically, we had this problem with invasive water hyacinth invading our waterways, which I believe was introduced just after the World's Fair into the U.S. Waterways. And it's an extremely invasive plant. It is almost impossible to eradicate without using chemical means. It grows super fast. It propagates underwater, so you can't just like mow it down. And this guy came up with this idea to import hippos with the idea that the hippos would eat the water hyacinth, and that would also solve the meat shortage that we were experiencing in the U.S. Because he was like, well, great, you know, the hippos will eat the water hyacinth, and then we'll eat the hippos, and everybody wins. Unfortunately, he didn't take into account the fact that hippos are one of the most violent animals on land. They are murderous, and I'm sorry, can I swear on this podcast, or should I not?
PG-13 is good.
Okay, all right. I won't use the word that I usually use for them. they're incredibly murderous and violent. They kill just because they can, and they kill humans like a lot all the time. He did not take this into account. He kind of thought that an American can-do-itiveness would take care of the problem, and that bill went to a vote, and it only failed to pass by one vote.
Oh, so basically we were just one vote away from all being murdered by hippos.
Exactly. I mean, they're extremely invasive megafauna. There's actually hippos this is in the news all the time these days, that there are hippos in Colombia because the DEA went down and busted up Pablo Escobar's compounds, which included zoos, and there were like four to six hippos that got just released into the wild, and the DEA was like, it's fine, they'll probably die because this isn't their native habitat. And instead they were like, no, we're hippos, nothing can kill us. And so they've been breeding, and they're taking over the waterways and destroying the biomes and causing all kinds of trouble.
And they're adorable. I mean, who would have thought?
it's a huge problem because they've got those little round ears, and I feel like our monkey brains see that and go, yeah, like, wow, that's a teddy bear. And the hippo looks at us and goes, oh, I can kill you with a thought. I mean, they can run faster underwater than humans can on land. Like, they're not to be trifled with. And so in the American Hippo novellas, I imagine that bill did pass. I bumped it back by about 50 years so that I could make this, you know, about cowboys and not have to deal with industry and stuff. And I imagine that this did happen, that the inevitable outcome occurred involving, you know, a U.S. boom and bust economy cycle, which involved like poor infrastructural planning. And the hippos got out, invaded the waterways, and now there's feral hippos in the Mississippi River.
That sounds incredible. And now I need to go back and read them. Are they available on your website or tour.com?
You can buy them anywhere books are sold. If you go to my website, sarahgailey.com, you can find links to where you can buy all of my books. I highly recommend your listeners getting them from their local library or from their local independent bookstore. And if it's difficult for listeners to get to those resources, you can also go to bookshop.org, which is a website that you can buy books from, and the funds and proceeds go to support independent booksellers nationwide.
Bookshop.org is amazing. It really is. So did you, so you went from the hippo pulp Western to, how did you make the transition to Magic for Liars, or was Upright Women Wanted sort of in the back of your mind and you were like, I'm going to get to that later?
Not at all. I went right to Magic for Liars. The way that happened is actually to do with how weird my publishing trajectory has been. I wrote the first of the American Hippo novellas, which is called River of Teeth. And it was the longest
thing. That's such a great title.
Thank you. And I wrote it. It was the longest thing I'd ever written. I kind of did it just to see if I could. And I didn't really have any idea that I was going to have a career in publishing at any point. But I'd been writing and publishing short stories and had my eye on the world of publishing, just kind of seeing what was going on. And there was this literary agent named Dongwon Song, who I saw on Twitter and on social media. And I always thought, gosh, if I ever did have a career in publishing, that would be my dream agent. He was so brilliant and said a lot of really smart things about the publishing process and about, you know, the responsibilities that writers and publishing professionals have to the community and to the world. And I was like, wow, that guy's just so cool and smart. And I had one of my first short stories published in Fireside Fiction magazine called Haunted. And shortly after it came out, I got an email through my website from Dongwon Song saying, hey, do you have time for a phone call? And I was like, yeah, okay, I have time for a phone call, sure. And we got on the phone and he said, you know, do you have like a novel idea? And I was like, well, no, but I have this novella. And he said, all right, you know, well, it's really impossible for a literary agent to represent someone based on short fiction alone, because the literary agents make their money on commission. They make a percentage of whatever the authors make, and short fiction just doesn't make enough money for most people to justify literary agents' time. And he said, you know, but if you ever come up with a novel idea, let me know, because I would love to talk. And in the meantime, why don't I take a look, just as a favor, take a look at that novella, and I'll give you some editorial feedback, and maybe I can tell you who to point it at. And I said, great. Got off the phone with him, sent him the novella, and spent the next couple of weeks frantically trying to come up with an idea for a novel, because I was like, this is my chance to work with this amazing person. I have to take this opportunity, and maybe I can just come up with an idea for a novel, and he'll buy it, and like as a concept, not financially. And then I can like find a way to make short fiction work, because I didn't want to write a novel, because I was like, that sounds too hard.
Right, right.
And I came up with the concept for Magic for Liars, got back on the phone with him a couple weeks later to talk about River of Teeth. He gave me his feedback on River of Teeth, and I said, hey, so I came up with an idea for a novel, and it's like Veronica Mars, but at Hogwarts. What do you think? And we talked it through, and he said, great, I'd love to represent you. And then we got off the phone, and I thought, dang, now I have to write a novel.
It's a fantastic novel, though. I just tore through it. I loved it.
Oh, thank you so much. It really changed me as a writer. It made me realize that long form fiction, novel length, is a place that I can really flourish. And I haven't looked back since. Upright Women Wanted is actually the first novella I've written since the American Hippo series. And I mean, I love it. I love working in novella length, but I'm so grateful that I got that kind of push to go a little bit farther.
I really loved it. So would you like to tell our listeners first a little bit about what Magic for Liars is about? And then I can tear into what I loved about it.
Yes, Magic for Lawyers came a long way from that Veronica Mars at Hogwarts pitch, but it's about a private investigator who is trying to solve the murder of a faculty member at a high school for magical teens. The private investigator doesn't have magic powers herself, but her estranged twin sister does and happens to be a teacher at that high school. It's very much about identity, duality, family, and the lies that we tell ourselves to try and justify the things we do.
Some of the things I loved most about it was, first of all, the main character I thought was just such a good character. You know, you have this like hard-boiled detective, but it was unlike any hard-boiled detective in a fantasy world that I've ever read before, because it felt so grounded. I mean, so you go to this magical school, but it really, like, even more so than Hogwarts, which I guess, like, one of the things, I guess that's, is that middle fantasy where it's sort of based in our world, and I always get my fantasies mixed up.
This is a contemporary fantasy.
Contemporary fantasy. Okay, so contemporary fantasy where, like, you can switch back to kind of, like, where we are, and then you go to another world. So, you know, that was, like, I think that's one of the things that's brought a lot of people into the fantasy world through the Harry Potter age, where, you know, like, where they might have found high fantasy a little too lofty for them, this was something they could relate to, because they were introduced to the world as Harry was introduced to the world. And I think, like, this was so fresh. It felt like a real high school, where you have the faculty is messed up. Like, the faculty is basically like kids themselves. And looking back, I mean, I went here to Syosset High School, and I'm not going to say anything bad about it because it was a great experience. But when you know some of the things that are going on, you're just like, man, these adults are sort of like high school kids themselves sometimes.
I mean, aren't we all?
We really are. Yeah.
In writing the high school in Magic for Liars, I really wanted to sort of be in conversation with, you know, and this whole book obviously is very much in conversation with the Harry Potter series, which was very formative for me, and which, you know, as I've grown as a person and as a writer, my relationship with that series has shifted considerably. But in creating the high school in Magic for Liars, I wanted to be in conversation with the magical school tropes that Harry Potter really established for a lot of people. Like, you go to this amazing castle, and it completely changes everything, and it's an institution unto itself. I really wanted to bring a sense of reality into that, in that, you know, contemporary American high schools, whether they're public or private, are so much defined by the students in them. Mm-hmm. Teenagers live in a constant state of defining their space and defining themselves and trying to carve out some kind of identity, and trying to get the world to see and recognize that identity. And so I wanted to write a real high school that has, like, you know, gum on the floors and graffiti, and signs that children inhabit this place and define it. And when I wrote it, I was married to a high school teacher, and I got to really see kind of that faculty side that you were talking about.
Yeah.
And I wanted to bring that in too, that these faculty members are people who are doing their best all the time, trying to do their best by the kids, trying to do their best by each other, but the pressures of their job take a toll.
Absolutely. And working with teenagers takes a toll, and it's like a whole mindset, because in a lot of ways, and I have a brother who is a high school teacher, when you get into teaching, some of these teachers are not that far removed from their own high school period. So it's like you go right from high school to college to, and then you go back to high school, and you're trying to figure out, you know, like what you're doing as well. One of the things I also thought was interesting was the school, it was like anti-prophecy, like, there's a prophecy. We're not going to deal with prophecies. Like, no. Like, oh, but there's a prophecy. No, we don't want to hear about that. I thought that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's part of being married to that high school teacher was that I got a lot of insight into the boundaries that good teachers and school administrators need to have with their students. I think, you know, from the student side, you kind of get this sense of either like nice teachers or mean teachers, and teachers who feel like your friends, and teachers who feel like your friends in ways that you realize as an adult are not appropriate.
Yeah.
I know that I am not alone in having had a lot of high school teachers who did not have appropriate boundaries, either on accident or on purpose. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to really reinforce this idea that, like, no, a school, like the faculty and administrators and teachers at the school shouldn't be directly invested in your personal prophecy. That's not what they're there for. That's not their role in your life. And at the same time, you know, the characters in this book are highly flawed, and the lack of support that some of the administrators showed as students who are struggling is not intended to always be endorsed. It's in many ways a picture of the way that we neglect students as a result of becoming tired and jaded from years and years of working with them.
And then you have the relationship between the sisters. And that was so beautifully layered. You have Ivy, she has like, I don't know how you would, like, how would you describe it? Like, so she's non-magical and Tabitha is magical and they're twin sisters.
Right.
That's got to sting just a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, and, you know, again, like, not to keep mentioning, like, the series that shall not be named, but Harry Potter, like, you kind of got a glimpse at the end that, what's her name, that Petunia was always hurt by the fact that she was non-magical and Lily was. So, yeah, that's, that, it does have to sting a bit. I mean, I know if it was me, I'd want to have the magical powers.
Yeah, I mean, their relationship is so central to the story, and one of the primary themes of that relationship is the bitterness that comes up between siblings who have different skills and different abilities. This sister relationship is not based on my own relationship with my sisters, but one of my older sisters is one of the most academically brilliant people I've ever met in my life. She is, like super, 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 super smart, and that's she's smart in a way that I'm not, right? She's like, she understands organic chemistry. She's like good at calculus. And I wanted to write a little bit about what it's like to see your sibling excelling in ways that you are just not capable of excelling. I definitely heard from that sister when this book came out, and she was like, hey, are we okay? because this book very much leans into what can happen if that relationship sours, if there's distance, if the heart of the relationship isn't well cared for, and that bitterness is allowed to thrive.
Yeah, and I'm a mother of twins myself, so it's very interesting just, you know, watching two children of the exact same age grow up at the same time and experience the same things, but just digest and, you know, sort of explore them so differently.
Yeah, I cannot imagine what that's like from a parent's perspective. That must be incredible.
It's certainly something, I'll tell you that much. So, Upright Women Wanted. I have to ask, librarians as awesome, badass fighters, I'm loving this. It's been coming up in a few different books throughout the last few years. Why us? I love it. I know that my colleagues love it, but as a writer, why librarians?
Oh gosh, there's so many different answers to that question because there's so many reasons. I mean, first and foremost, librarians are huge champions in the reading, writing, and publishing community. I mean, librarians and independent booksellers are what make my entire life possible. And so, of course, I want to celebrate librarians and libraries at every turn. In my own personal history, I grew up in two places. I grew up in the back room of an independent bookstore where my mother worked and roaming feral through the library where she volunteered. So I have always been like just deeply immersed in libraries. And also one of the most important people in my life is a librarian. One of the people who I live with, who is my dearest friend in the entire world, is a middle school librarian. And I get to see kind of the behind the scenes of how hard she fights for the rights of her students, the needs of her students, access to information, access to data, and data and information literacy. I get to see all of that from behind the scenes and how important librarians are in maintaining free access to information and free access to true information, and in trying to teach people how to process information in a way that is really difficult to maintain, especially in the current climate in the US. And lastly, the librarians in this book are based on real librarians.
Oh my gosh, please tell me about that. Okay.
Yes.
So define librarians in Upright Women Wanted.
Okay, so in Upright Women Wanted, I should tell your listeners a little bit about the book.
Yes,
Upright Women Wanted is a pulp western that takes place in the near future fascist-controlled American Southwest. It is about queer anti-fascist spy librarians on horseback, and the librarians in this world are an order of women who travel from town to town on horseback delivering approved material, which is any kind of media that the fascist government has approved for consumption by citizens. That is based on, you know, real fascist regimes across the spectrum of control, from American textbook regulations, where one board of educators in Texas decides what textbooks Americans all across the country are going to read based on what values they think the American children should be absorbing about the country, all the way to, you know, your kind of like classical Soviet propaganda machine of saying, okay, well, we're only going to sing songs that glorify the country. So that's based in reality, and the librarians on horseback are based on a real program in America. During the Great Depression in 1939, the Works Progress Administration developed all kinds of programs to give unemployed Americans jobs. Things like, you know, building houses and dams and railroads, and one of those programs was actually designed with the future in mind. It was designed with this idea that poor, isolated people weren't going to be able to get educations that they needed in order to enter a future workforce that was focused less on manual labor and more on like information and more white collar jobs. And so they developed this program to try to educate people who were isolated, especially in rural areas, especially in Appalachian communities, where they put women on horseback with reading materials and sent them around to these isolated people to deliver books. And that program is the very foundation of Upright Women Wanted. In Upright Women Wanted, the U.S. has kind of continued the trajectory that it's currently on of becoming an imperialist fascist state. And when that happens to a nation, resources get centralized to the military, which is happening now. If you look at our national and state and like city level budgets, you see a ton of resources going to militarized police forces and not a ton of resources going to things like road repair and schools and, you know, clinics and other much needed services. So in Upright Women Wanted, that's just been continuing the way that it's already going. Most of the resources are going to the military, and as a result, citizens have to live in a way that we lived, you know, in the like late 1800s, where we don't have well-paved and maintained roads, and we don't have rubber for our tires because that's all going to the military. So people are on horseback. It's a return to that kind of living that is necessitated by the way the country isn't taking care of the people anymore. And so the only way that you can access new materials is when the librarians come to town to deliver new books, movies, music, and media that has been approved by the state.
And the main character wants to get out of town for a completely different reason. So yes. She ends up hiding out with the librarians.
Yes. So the main character, Esther, is queer and has been in love with her best friend and in a relationship with her best friend. But that best friend is executed for possession of unapproved materials and for deviant behavior, which is also something that has been common in the U.S., especially during darker times and, you know, the rise of the Hays Code. The main character, Esther, sees this and decides to run away from home because she has internalized the idea that that is the fate that waits for people like her, for deviants, for queer people who don't love other people the way that the fascist-controlled state wants them to. She's internalized that idea from the media that she's consumed, which is true for so many queer people in the world and in the U.S. today. For a long time, something called the Hays Code, which I just mentioned, was controlling narratives in American media. And one of the ways that it controlled those narratives is that deviant lifestyles could not be glamorized, which means that if you had a character who was being portrayed in any way as homosexual, the narrative needed to make sure the audience understood that that character was bad and that bad things were going to happen to them because of the life they lived. So, you know, a lot of narratives at the time, if they contain queerness at all, even just queer coding, tragedy waited for the character who was being coded as queer.
Mm-hmm. I was just watching, this is like as an aside, I was just watching both the original Aladdin and Lion King with my kids. And like both Jafar and Scar, I'm like, ouch.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I knew it as a kid too. But I wasn't really sure how to put it into words until, you know, you read a lot about the queer-coded characters in Disney, and it's like, it's there.
It's so there.
So there.
One thing that I find fascinating about, especially about queer-coded characters in Disney, is that a lot of the storytellers and animators behind those stories were themselves queer. Yeah. And the only way that they could put themselves and members of their community on the screen was to make them villains, which is part of why, like, Ursula from The Little Mermaid is one of the greatest villains of all time. She's fascinating and people love her. Mm-hmm. She is so many people's favorite character because she's interesting, she's dynamic, right? These queer-coded characters are drawn in such a way that they're visually fascinating. Children remember them and latch onto them. They don't have that kind of samey, same face that a lot of the protagonists do. But of course, because of the way that media messaging was kind of anchored on the heterosexual nuclear family model at the time, those characters had to be villains and they had to meet a bad end.
I'm so sorry to interrupt. I'm trying to remember. I seem to remember reading someplace that Ursula was based on a drag queen.
Yes, Divine, the drag queen Divine.
John Waters.
Yes, yeah, Ursula was yes. Famously based on her. And I mean, this serves a purpose, right? It reinforces right. This idea that yeah. queerness is inherently bad. It makes you feel scared and wrong when you realize that you are like Ursula, or like Jafar, or like Scar, right? And Esther, the main character in Upright Women Wanted, like so many people in my own queer community, has internalized these ideas. And so she runs away from home with the idea that she'll join the librarians. They're supposed to be chaste, morally upright women who are dedicated to the state, and they'll teach her how to be good and how to be the kind of person she's supposed to be. And at the very least, she'll get herself and the tragedy that's destined to befall her away from the people she loves. And the book is really about learning how to let go of that idea that tragedy is the end for queer people. You know, we're going to experience tragedy. Everybody does. Esther's story starts with a huge tragedy, but she learns that there's also joy and there's also hope and there's also a big fight that she can take part in to try and make the world different.
And she's able to use some of the skills that she has in ways that I think really surprises the librarians.
Yes. This is something that is so dear to my heart. I'm just right now rereading Patricia C. Reed's Dealing with Dragons series, in which Princess Cimmerine runs away from home because she doesn't want to be a proper princess. And she ends up running away to live with dragons and be their princess. They're kind of like a housekeeper. And she uses skills that she learned over the course of her life, to do well at that. And one of those big skills is cooking and cleaning. I think that we so often as a culture devalue work that is traditionally assigned to women, in especially in, you know, very patriarchal heteronormative households, like cooking and cleaning and childcare. Even though that work is incredibly useful and skilled and difficult and important to living any kind of life, Esther has grown up in a culture that demands that she does women's work and that she is like a proper woman. And when she winds up on the road with these librarians, there's a lot she doesn't know, but there's a lot she does know. She right. knows how to cook, she knows how to sew, she knows how to mend things, and she brings those skills into a group of people who need those skills.
And she finds a little bit of romance on the way.
Yes, she does. I could not resist.
I liked that it was there. It wasn't like central to the story, but it was there and it was nice. And those two, the two characters, there is some love in general. And I don't want to go into everybody because I want the readers to experience it for themselves, but they really needed, I think that like they really needed each other at that time. And it was just so well done. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Some people have mentioned that it seems a little abrupt that Esther would find romance so soon after her friend and former lover is killed. And actually, in early drafts of the book, I had pulled back on the romance for that reason. And my brilliant editor, Rishi Chen at Tor.com, said, listen, if you're trying to tell people with this book that there's hope and that they can have good things, you've got to give them some good things. Let your reader see some people kiss. And I was like, great. And just went all out.
It was wonderful. I loved it. It was so good. So I see that you have something coming out in February.
I do. The Echo Wife is my second adult novel from Tor. And that comes out in February of 2021, which feels a million light years away. And also like it is tomorrow.
Because 2020 never really happened. We never left our house.
No.
We're still
exactly.
Oh man. Yeah. So what's it about? Can you tell us?
I can. The Echo Wife is the story of Evelyn Caldwell, who is the scientist who invents adult duplicative cloning, which is the kind of science fiction cloning where like I've got one of you and then poof, I've got another one of you in a big test tube. And it's the story of the year after she divorces her husband, Nathan, because she finds out that he is having an affair with a clone of her that he created by stealing her technology in order to create a less threatening version of her.
That sounds amazing. I hope that you would be willing to come back and talk to us about that once it comes out.
Oh my gosh, of course, I would love to.
And we are going to have you virtually here on September 24th for a virtual author BYOB, where our listeners can ask you about your books themselves and you could do a little reading. And we're very excited for that.
I am so looking forward to it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for everything.
Thank you.
Once again, this was Jessica with Syosset Libraries Turn the Page, and our guest today was?
Sarah Gailey. I will see you in September.
I will see you in September, and we are going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.
I love editing.